Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Antique E Show. It's great to be on the air with you. This is my first show. I'm Leslie Gist Etheridge, your host. I'm looking forward to enlightening you about historically black books. I collect them myself, and I thought that you might be interested in collecting them also. I have some exciting guests coming by to visit, Mr. Tony Chaitin, a historian and author and editor, Larry Robbins, the bookstore owner out of Philadelphia, and a history administrator of a high school named Will Worley. So I'm waiting for these gentlemen to give us a call, and I think I already have Judy. Judy is our correspondent from New York City. She will be telling the listeners of all the latest and greatest places to go to purchase a book. So here we go. I'm going to connect you to Miss Judy first, and then I'll have Will and, of course, my mentor, Mr. Jerry Butler, the financier. We have three people on the line waiting to talk, so let's see if we can get them on. Hold on 1 second. All right, Judy, are you on the air?
Yes, I am. Hello, hello, Leslie. It's Judy, and happy Memorial Day weekend.
Great, great. Thanks, Judy. So I know you're out at a cookout and on and about celebrating like many other people are. Could you tell our listeners where's the hottest and latest and the greatest places to go if you want to find some good books?
Okay, Leslie. Well, as you know, the Book Expo America comes to New York City once every 3 years. And this year, of course, is at the Jacob Javits Center. And it's going to be a big, big event. The Jacob Javits Center, for those of you that don't know, it's at 655 West 34th Street off 11th Avenue. And if you're a bookseller, a bookstore person, an educator, a librarian, you could come in for a one-day pass. It's $80. And a three-day pass is $130 to get in. And once you're in, from 9 to 5, all the books are free.
Okay,
there will be over
What do you mean by all the books? Could you give our listeners
there's going to be over 500 authors at this event. 500 authors. I have no idea how many publishers. This is the largest trade show in the country. Next year, it will be in Los Angeles, and the year after, it will be in Washington, D.C. If you wish to check out the website, it's www.bea.com, and you'll get a lot more information. There will be specific seminars if you're looking to learn how to publish your work, or you want to have breakfast with an author, or you want to have lunch. Those are separate events. But once you get a pass with your name on it to enter that day for the event, everything inside is free. You're not paying for the books. A lot of these books are books that won't be out for 6 months. So a lot of famous authors, Walter Dean Myers and his son will be there. Omar Tyree will be there. I understand Carl Weber. There's even an African-American pavilion on the main floor.
Okay. Judy, tell them what they should bring. Tell them, talk to them as if you were talking to me.
Oh, definitely. If you're coming, if you decide to come and you pay your $80 for a one-day pass to be in there from 9 to 5, I strongly suggest you bring the biggest suitcase on wheels that you can find, the largest suitcase, because people are giving you all kinds of books of different genres, from series. You'll be getting all kinds of cards from people letting you know whether or not they come to schools or churches to speak, different publishers and what they do. Sometimes you get T-shirts, sometimes you get canvas bags. So you're not allowed to bring your suitcase on the floor. There's a section where you check where the bags are checked, and they give you canvas bags, similar to when you go into the store Old Navy. You load up, and when your shoulders get too heavy, everybody, just go to the main area and fill your suitcase up and then go back on the floor.
Okay, Judy. I'm going to tap in another caller. 757-538. Could you hold on, Judy?
Yes, I can.
All right. Caller 757, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Jerry Butler. How are you?
Great. Jerry, this is, of course, your dear friend Leslie.
How well I know. And, I just wanted to say, Judy, it's indeed a pleasure to be here on this monumental day with Leslie. And also, I just love hearing you disseminate all that great information about the event that's going to be happening in New York. And right now I'm looking for a suitcase to see how I can get on that floor and get me all the books I can.
I hear you.
Okay. Now, Jerry is going to host a show with me. He's the one that introduced me to the family, and I'm going to read off his bio. As soon as we tap in the next caller, which is 862, and you're on the air. 862, are you there?
Yes, this is Will.
Okay. This is Will, the administrator, the historian.
Yes,
I want to introduce you, Mr. Will, to Judy, our correspondent in the field that will go out and tell us about all the book events all over the country. And we also have the great financier, Mr. Jerry Butler. He's here. He's going to talk to us about financing. And, of course, you know my views on financing during this terrible time. A economic time is to invest in books and black literature, black paintings, and things of that nature. Could you give us a few notes on your background, Will?
Sure. I'm currently working for the York Public Schools, Westside High School, as the social studies department chairperson. I've been in the field of education for the past 14 years, started off as a history teacher in East Orange Public Schools, and then transitioned to Newark as the for the last 5 years as the department chair for social studies.
Okay. And I asked Will to be a part of the show to talk to the audience about Juneteenth holiday. So later on, when we get finished with Judy's segment, we'll address Will's segment, which will be Juneteenth, the holiday Juneteenth. Jerry, you want to help me out with Judy?
Well, Judy, exactly. Is there a particular website that we can give the listeners that they can actually log on to be able to see all the activities that will be going on, or either some place that actually they can just keep up with the itinerary of where there will be other local events or just nationwide events such as this?
Well, right now, the book club that I'm a member of, Sugar and Spice Book Club, www.sugarandspicebookclub.com. I'm trying to remember .com and .org.com. We have an events site, and we have the listing there of the Jacob Javits convention, the book convention, the Harlem Book Fair, which is July 18th. On 135th Street and Malcolm X Boulevard from 9 in the morning till 6 p.m. And, of course, before the 18th, the 17th, they have the Wheatley Awards, the Phyllis Wheatley Awards that evening, celebrating the latest in literacy. So you have that event, and you have the National Book Club Conference in Atlanta, Georgia, which is an outstanding event. It's that Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. August 1st and 2nd, I suggest people come down on the 31st to Atlanta. It's in the Marriott, downtown Atlanta, up the street from the Gladys Knight Waffle and Chicken Restaurant.
Hmm.
And there you will have Patti LaBelle. You will have an honoring of Dr. Cornel West. You will have a number of well-known and new authors coming out to speak to the book clubs, to speak to people that are avid readers, to let them know what's out there and what they should be reading to be in touch.
Now, Sugar and Spice, is that S-U-G-A-R-A-N-D or S-U-G-A, okay, Sugar and Spice. Now, have you deciphered whether it's .org or .com? What is it?
It's bookclub.com. It's
wait,
book
wait, Sugar, Sugar and Spice Book Club.
Yes.
.com.
Yes, I, you know, sometimes you forget because you're doing so many things, but Sugar and, no, Sugar and Spice, I'm sorry, I got the card, bookclub.org.
Okay,
I correct myself.
That's why I didn't want to say too much until I was actually sure that you were sure. Okay, so listeners, that's www.sugarandspicebookclub.org. Now, is there a number for any listeners to actually call if they are requesting any additional information, Judy?
Well, they can call me on my cell, 917-292-9810. They could also email me at my own website, which is my name, Judy, J-U-D-I, as in Judy, Bell, B-E-L-L-E, R-A-I-N-E-S, at AOL.com. Because
okay.
There's so many book events. We just missed the book event that was in Texas recently, the Black Book Festival, which I believe this is their fifth or sixth annual festival, and it was held in Houston, Texas, I believe, and there were a lot of authors there, and there was a lot of success last weekend.
Now,
so,
did you mention the book fair in Atlanta?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
That's the National Book Club Conference. The founder, Mr. Curtis Bunn, who's been doing an outstanding job every year. It gets bigger and bigger. Last year we had 500 attendees of clubs from all over the United States conversing and talking about, what are you reading?
Okay.
So it was exciting to see so many people of different hues, not just African-American diaspora, but of different hues, discussing what was important to them, what their club was reading. A lot of these clubs were co-ed. They're not just all women, you know, and it was very exciting to see.
Now, what is the proper spelling of the last name for Curtis, for the listeners?
Curtis Bunn, B-U-N-N.
Okay.
The website is www.nationalbookclubconference.com.
Wait a minute, National Book
Club. Bookclubconference.com. And Terry McMillan will be there. There'll be a lot of people. California Cooper will be there.
All right.
Okay,
you got
I
a
have
lot
a
of
quick question for Mr. Worley. Will, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, we're talking about book fairs and things of that nature. You're in the school system. Could you tell us the importance of book fairs and how they can relate in the classroom with your history teachers?
Well, they're very important and necessary. In fact, most of the students, unfortunately, don't read outside of required readings that are given by their teachers. And most of the teachers, after they're finished with their formal schooling, don't read outside and don't read literature that will inform particularly African-American students. And so what Judy is talking about is very important and necessary for students as well as teachers to get books by authors of African-American descent and that will give them the opportunity to have a perspective on, what is it that black authors have to say about politics, some social issues, even educational issues and things that impact students. So these fairs, I think, are very necessary. And, in fact, I believe we need to have more of them, particularly here in the city of Newark, to expose students to just good books. There are a lot of books that students read, particularly the females, that are very raunchy, type of books and X-rated books with nothing that builds their character, their self-esteem, and teach them something about their history and their culture.
Very good point. Very good point.
Judy, you also work in the school system.
Yes.
Can you respond or add to Will's comment?
Well, a lot of students in school, some of them do read things that are inappropriate for them. But when I spoke to a lot of the students at my high school, particularly in Queens, Martin Van Buren High School, and I asked the students what was their favorite book, a lot of the students, I was surprised, they said was Monster by Walter Dean Myers. A lot of the students read things that are inappropriate, and some of the students are reading The Pact, you know, by the three African-American doctors, The Pursuit of Happiness, The Meridian of Gifted Hands by Dr. Ben Carson. You know, we don't see this on the train and the bus, and some of the kids are taught, well, if you're reading, you're a nerd,
right.
You know, but they are reading.
Okay, now, Will, he's out of Newark. He will know a lot about the book, The Pact. Could you explain to the listeners about The Pact?
Well, actually, the three gentlemen, the three doctors, are former students from West High School. Hello?
I'm here. Yes. I can hear you.
Okay.
Kind of static.
Yes. The book is about an agreement that these three gentlemen made to essentially support one another and each other, not only through high school, but also through college and medical school, to ensure that they all, you know, get their degrees and become doctors and successful in their career. And so that book is actually required reading for the students at most of the high schools, if not all of them in the city of Newark, for the students to read. So our students are exposed to that. And if I could just just piggyback on what we were talking about a few minutes ago, is that there are books such as, obviously, The Pact and Monster that students are exposed to, but those are books that the teachers ask them to read. And what I'm finding, or what I've found, is that the students, particularly the males, don't go out and pick up books to read just for their own personal edification. And then when we do assign those books, they're doing it as a requirement, just to fulfill a basic core requirement, but not necessarily to inspire them. So I guess that's part of our job as educators, is to use texts like that to, you know, help inspire the students. But The Pact is certainly, you know, one of the books that students are required to read, I believe, in their ninth grade year, between their ninth and tenth grade year.
Excellent. Jerry, you have anything to say?
Well, I'd like to welcome you, Will. And I would like to ask you, do you feel that there in the school system, they should have more required reading that involves Black history?
Yes, I do think that there should be more. In fact, you know, we have an African American history course. It is given as an elective, which students, you know, unfortunately, particularly the seniors, they'll get in the class and are reluctant to stay in the course because they'll say that they don't need it to graduate. They've already fulfilled their requirements. One of the things that I tell them, and this is probably one of the most powerful classes they'll ever take, because in there it should expose them to authors, you know, such as, you know, Malefe Asante or Maulana Ferenga, Wade Nobles and others. That course will give them the opportunity to hear those names and if not read entire texts that they wrote, and at least excerpts of books. And articles from, you know, people such as that.
Okay.
I have a recommendation. You know, I work in high school also. I teach electronics. Field trips. Have you ever thought of or have you had field trips with your students to expose them to these book fairs? I'm asking this question to both Judy and Will. Is that something that the schools are looking into?
I have not personally had a trip or sponsored a trip. I do know that the elementary schools normally have book fairs that come into the school. And, in fact, our media specialist at our school does have a book fair for the high school students, and Jackie Harwick, I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly, came in quite recently for the book fair that we had at the school. So there is some, probably not enough, but there is an attempt by media specialists to have at least bring the book fairs into the schools.
I took students, I used to take 7th grade and 8th grade students to Atlanta, Georgia to expose them to Morehouse Film and Atlanta Cloth, Morris Brown, the libraries, to the museums, of course, to Dr. King's entombment, and tied it in the importance of literacy. I've taken them to the Schomburg Library. I've taken them to the Langston Hughes Library. A lot of times the students are not exposed to books in the right way. They have cut down on having book fairs inside of the New York City public schools. There's definitely an opportunity for the students to go to the Harlem Book Fair, which is one of the big book fairs. There are book fairs constantly around the Central Park area to talk to their place of worship to see if they're holding book fairs, because books are very popular and they're all around the students. So I've taken them to libraries within the New York area, in the Boston area, and, you know.
Okay.
Outside.
Okay. Jerry, you have anything to ask, or anyone has anything to add to this conversation?
Well, you know, actually, I won't sit here and sound like I'm a well-versed individual on my own black history, because I'm not. Would you please explain to the listeners about that, just that name, the Schomburg? Am I even pronouncing that right, Judy? Please help me. I need all the help I can get.
Arthur Schomburg was an educator, was a famous historian who believed that the wealth of information and knowledge and gifts from the African-American diaspora needed to be put together into a large collection, into a large resource where people could have the experience of just learning for fun, for enjoyment, and just take advantage of all the wealth of education that Africans have accomplished during their existence here on Earth. And it is one of the greatest places that we can even expose our youth to, because there's just, I mean, they have actual shackles that slaves wore, and they talk about the African burial ground and the authentic, actually the first printing of the Underground Railroad by William Still. And they have a, right now they have a big seminar on the teachings and the autobiography of Malcolm X. They have a, you know, a display. It's just an outstanding, I don't know where to begin to talk, but everyone has a chance to go there at least
once in a lifetime.
It's just this wealth of information.
And it's located on Malcolm X Boulevard, right around the corner from Sylvia, so if you get hungry,
that's right.
A great place.
It's right there.
It's a local restaurant in itself. I guess we're done talking about different book events. Anything you want to add, a place that you've been, Judy?
I want to say to people that want to collect rare books, some people are into collecting rare books, or they're trying to get books that are out of print. The
right.
Strand Bookstore on 828 Broadway in Manhattan on 12th Street is a great resource for buying new, used, and rare books, and they're reasonably priced. I went in there the other day and bought a book for a quarter. I mean, it's unbelievable. The resources that we have at our fingertips that many of us aren't aware of, and, of course, you can email www.strandbooks.com, and you can ask if they have a particular book before you go down there. Their phone number is 212-473-1452. Then you have
say that one more time really slow.
Yes.
The name and the phone number.
Okay. The email is www.
Oh, that's the website.
The website, strandbooks.com. The address to get there is 828 Broadway on 12th Street in Manhattan, New York.
The phone number.
The phone number is 212 473-1452. And in under one roof, you have 8 piles of new, used, and rare books.
How much?
How much did you purchase that book for? We want to hear that again,
poetry book for 25 cents. I mean, you know, they've got it all. The price range is just, it's unbelievable. Then you've got the Gotham Bookmark, which reopened on 16 East 46th Street. And their phone number is 212-719-4448. I got my first edition of Richard Wright.
One more time, slower.
I'm sorry.
That's the Gotham what now?
It's called the Gotham, G as in go.
Yeah, I got that.
C-H-A-M, Bookmart. It had closed. It used to be on 1747th Street. Now it's reopened at 16 East 46th Street. The phone number there is 212-719-4448. They, too, are known for their used and rare books. If you're trying to get first editions by, I'm a Richard Wright, Langston Hughes, Dr. Maya Angelou fan. I got a lot of Richard Wrights on sale, some for $4, first editions, some with $25. The prices vary. These are great places. And if you happen to be taking a course and in the neighborhood of an Ivy League school like Harvard, Yale, Princeton, anywhere around those schools where you see small bookstores, go in because a lot of gems for African American history are right in those stores. Very modest, you know, very low price.
Right, right.
Okay, I think those places are great places to have a field trip. Where you,
yes.
When your students are out, I think those are places you should stop at.
Yes, and
no
my
doubt.
Students have gone to those areas and just came home with bags and bags of books. So they are reading.
That's fantastic, truly fantastic. And I really think listeners really need to broaden their horizons. And, again, we're talking about just a few of the places, Strand Bookstore, if you wanted to look for rare books and also books at a very cheap price. You can even give them a call at area code 212-473-1452. They also have a website that you can visit, which is www.strand. Judith, is it strand.books.com?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. And also we have Gotham Bookmart. And you can call there as well and possibly get some information ahead of time, and they can be reached at area code 212-719-4448. Again, that's Gotham Bookmart. Is that correct?
Yes, correct.
And just to go back over a little bit of what we've asked, just to revisit some that we've talked to before, you're able to go to www.sugarandspicebookclub.org, where you'll be able to actually get an itinerary for the various book events. You've been listening to Judy Bell Rains. She can be reached at judybellrains@aol.com. Also, she can be even reached directly at area code 917-292-9810. Again, area code 917-292-9817. And some of the places that you can look forward to find out about the events that are up and coming would be the one that's even in Atlanta that's being hosted by just the founder, Curtis Bunn.
Yes.
And you can visit that website, which is www.nationalbookclubconference.com. Again, that's www.nationalbookclubconference.com.
Okay, we're going to go to a break. We have Mr. Larry Robbins on waiting to talk to us, so we're going to go to a one-and-a-half-minute break, and then we're going to bring him in, and we're going to repeat all this excellent information that Judy Bell Rains gave us as far as what's going on in the book world. So hold tight, and hold on, everybody, and I'll be right back.
All right.
Okay.
Oh, is this Mr. Larry Robbins?
Hi.
How are you? Hi,
good.
Mr. Robbins. This is Leslie Gist. I'm your host of the Black Antique E-Show, and we have on the line, you're joining Mr. Will Worley. He is administrator of the history department in a high school in Newark, New Jersey. You also have Judy Bell Raines. She is our correspondent in the field. She's telling us the latest and greatest places to visit as far as books, like your bookstore in Philadelphia. And we also have Mr. Tony Chaitin from Virginia. He's on the line. He's going to also chime in on the importance of the historical celebration called Juneteenth. And, of course, we have my co-host, who's really hosting the show, Mr. Jerry Butler. So I think that's everyone. You could say hello to Larry Robbins. He owns the oldest independent bookstore in Philadelphia.
Welcome, Larry. How are you?
Hi. How's everyone doing tonight?
How you doing? I'm doing just great, and I'm just honored to have you here. We've heard so much about you, and now we just have the esteemed pleasure of having you in the house.
Thank you.
So go right ahead, Leslie. I'm sure you just bubbling over with so many questions that you want to ask this living icon.
Okay. Mr. Larry Robbins, tell us about your bookstore, how it was founded, and just give our listeners some information, some background information of how the bookstore was even established.
Okay, my grandfather started my bookstore in 1936, and I came to it when I got out of high school in 1960. And the 60s were just, a wonderful period of change. And as I came into it, the paperbacks were first beginning to be published in large amounts. And, of course, it was the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement, and we kept brought into the store books on the Civil Rights Movement, and books by black authors, and books on history, and all sorts of things that weren't generally available.
Okay. And how old were you when, if you don't mind telling us, how old were you when your grandfather opened the store?
I wasn't born yet.
Oh.
All right. He opened in 36. I wasn't born until 42.
Wow. As a child, how did it feel to be around all those books?
Well, you know, you grow up in something, you don't think much about it.
okay.
But, I just always had access to literature and great language, and it's really shaped my life. And, I mean, the reason that we've connected is because of Lorraine Carey and the celebration. This is the 25th anniversary of the celebration of black writing here in Philadelphia.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I founded that 25 years ago, and that's kind of what brings us to this point. That's what I was saying, that when I came into the book business, there was very little black literature available, and it was because of the Civil Rights Movement and the politics that, first I read the political materials, and then I started reading black literature, and black literature started being published in larger, became more accessible, and publishers started publishing it because they basically didn't publish a whole lot of black literature.
Mm-hmm.
And because that's what I was reading, that's what I brought into the bookstore. And because it's what I brought into the bookstore, all these local writers were my customers and became my friends. And the way the celebration of black writing started was that we were, sitting around talking and saying, Philadelphia underrates its native population. I mean, we had these great black writers that live here in Philadelphia, and no one even knew it. And they were just kind of ignored. So we decided to have a party celebrating.
Just have a writer's party.
That's right. It seemed like a good idea. Who knows whether it would work or not. So we had this big party on a Sunday afternoon. And, we had these great people in town. Sonia Sanchez lives here. Houston Baker lives here. Charlie Fuller lives here. These are some of the biggest names in literature, black, white, whatever, right?
Right.
And they were all local Philadelphia writers, that held forth on a black aesthetic and the importance of black literature and black history. And here they all, they were here in Philadelphia. So we had this party, and all these people came, which was really great, so we decided to do it again.
Now, when you say we, you mentioned Lorraine Carey, and I think she's a very important person in our relationship, the two of us. I tried to get her on, but she is pooped from organizing the event, so she cannot make this conversation.
Right.
Can you give the audience a background of who Lorraine Carey is and why you think she's so special?
We 25 years ago, it was 83, 84 when we started this, and she was actually just going to U of Penn, and her teachers were Houston Baker, who was head of the Black Studies Department, it was Center for the Study of Black Culture, and in the English department, her mentor was Kristen Hunter Latney, who was this wonderful, great writer. And they were the people that were bringing Lorraine along, and they were giant names in black literature then. And they kind of guided her. And she broke through with her first book called Black Ice, which was this, the memoir of her growing up and going to this, prestigious white prep school and getting a scholarship and becoming a writer. As far as I think her greatest record, she wrote this book called Price of a Child, and it's just an amazing book, because what it does is it takes a real incident, which is Jane Johnson's escape from slavery here in Philadelphia, and puts it into a novel so that the thing about history is that you don't know all the facts. I mean, we know what we know, and there's all these gaps. But when you make it into a novel, you can fill in those gaps. You can use your understanding of human psychology and the way people interact and fill in the history so that it brings the history alive. And that's what Lorraine does with Price of a Child. She just what the story is this plantation owner comes to Philadelphia and brings along this woman, her slave. And when she gets to Philadelphia, she meets these people in the Underground Railroad, and she has a chance to escape. But they've kept her child on the plantation down south. So in order to gain her freedom, she has to abandon her child.
Right.
Which is
Larry, I just want to bring in introduce Tony Chaitin. Tony, I know you're there. Can you say hello?
Yeah, hello.
And
hello,
Tony,
everybody.
Do you have any questions? You want to make a comment about his story? The story he's talking about is a lady named Jane Johnson, and her master, Colonel Wheeler. Do you have anything to say?
I was just preparing a little bit of a little story about Juneteenth in Texas. So.
Okay, so we'll get back to you in about
okay.
5 minutes.
Yes.
All right. One more person I have to just introduce. You're online. 619. I'm going to put you on right now. Would you say hello to our guest? 619. Okay. Hello. Are you there?
Yes. This is Judy.
Oh, okay. I'm looking for 619.
Oh, okay.
All right. I'm gonna hang up on 619. All right, sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Larry Robbins. Would you continue on with Lorraine Carey's story, Price of a Child, her great book?
All right, so, this is just an amazing book about based on the true incident of the kind of courage and the kind of sacrifice it took to take advantage of the Underground Railroad and to get your freedom. And it goes into the abolitionist movement and how people were treated. We cannot conceive of what it took to strike out on your own and to grab your freedom in the world that was 100 years ago.
Now, Larry, we talked off the air about the five different books that you really like to talk about. Some of them are centered around the history, civil rights, Civil War era.
Right.
And I have two guests who would like to talk about Juneteenth, the holiday, the historical holiday. And
right.
They are the high school historical history administrator from Newark, New Jersey, and Tony Chaitin. Tony and Will, would you guys chime in about Juneteenth?
Okay. Well, Juneteenth, it's a holiday that was originally started in Texas on June 19th, 1865. A general from the Union Army, Gordon Granger, actually read the Emancipation Proclamation in Galveston, Texas. And from there, it spread from plantation to plantation. And the interesting thing about this particular day or celebration is that it was the Emancipation Proclamation was first given by President Lincoln in September of 1862 and became effective in January 1, 1863. So it was, 2.5 years after the proclamation was given, and about 2 months after the Civil War was actually over, when the enslaved Africans, the former enslaved Africans in Texas, got the news, and then the holiday eventually spread as these blacks migrated to other states and areas of the country. It spread throughout the country, so now currently, it became an official state holiday in Texas effective January 1, 1980, and there are 29 other states that now have it as an official or partial state holiday. Clearly in the African-American community, it's celebrated, with families, civic organizations, church organizations, and it's commonly, referred to as Emancipation Day. For African Americans, and then others of goodwill also celebrate with us on that particular day, June 19th.
Okay, Virginia, tell us about Juneteenth Day from your perspective, Mr. Tony Chaitin.
Oh, hi. Yeah, this is Tony Chaitin. I'm the history editor for Lyndon LaRouche's magazine, Executive Intelligence Review. The proclamation of the freedom of the slaves in Texas, which took place by the time when the Union troops took over Galveston, has a very important prehistory, and what followed that was spectacular in its drama and consequences in Texas and throughout for the country. Texas was not taken out of the Union by the people of Texas. There was a coup, a violent coup against the elected governor, Sam Houston, who refused to go against the United States. And he was taken out by the secessionist conspirators representing the power in the state by this faction. During the Civil War, Galveston, Texas, was very important as a place where the British, in particular, landed their blockade runners, and it was used. It became this element, the combination of the Confederacy and the British, remained an important element long afterwards in Texas, in their politics and in their sort of leadership groups. But what happened is right after the war, there was not freedom in reality for the black people in Texas or much of the South, especially under President Andrew Johnson, who was a real he knuckled under completely to the Southern aristocracy, and so when Congress took over the powers of Reconstruction in 1867, and then when General Grant became president, they put some troops down into the South to help enforce the freedom that was declared at the end of the Civil War. In Texas, there were two men in particular that were crucial in this process. One of them was a black political leader named Matthew Gaines, G-A-I-N-E-S. He had been a slave who had escaped repeatedly. He taught himself to read with smuggled books. And it's important to note that there were no public schools in Texas for anyone before the Civil War under slavery. And that was the condition throughout the South. Southern life was totally a decadent society. There was nothing good about it. And so this Gaines became a state senator after emancipation, under the protection of the United States in the Reconstruction era, and helped to put into power in Texas a governor named Edmund Davis, who had been a pro-Union Texas leader, who put together a Union army unit from Texas. So these were loyal people, loyal to the United States, and the most spectacular thing they did, taking advantage of emancipation and of protection from the U.S., was they established the first public school system in Texas. That is, for the whole state, they began building public schools and training teachers for whites and blacks. White people never had any public schools before this largely black-influenced state government was happening in Texas. Same thing was going on in other states like South Carolina. But there was a struggle for power, and especially after this terrible U.S. President Rutherford Hayes got in, he took the troops out of the South. These people were overthrown in Texas. There were false charges put in by the Klan elements against both these people, and Gaines was thrown out of politics, and the public schools were closed. And the public schools in Texas really never came back into existence in any real sense until the time of Franklin Roosevelt.
Okay, I think we have a question on the line. I hate to interrupt you, but let's see if this is true. Hold on. Hello, 267. Are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Do you have a question or are you comment?
Oh, no, I'm just signing in. I didn't have a question.
Oh, okay. Well, you want me to just let you hang on?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I just got in, so I really don't even know what the conversation is.
Okay. Yet. All right. We'll continue. Thanks for listening. Anyone on the panel have anything to add to what Tony is saying?
Yeah. This is Larry. All of public education was founded at the Civil War. At this point, I mean, you know, people don't think about it, but so much of the struggle for black rights has benefited poor whites. I mean, the public education didn't exist for anyone until Reconstruction and the attempt to to supply public education. But the public education was for everyone, black and white.
Right.
The real scandal is if you go to the Texas government websites today and look up these people. Yes, they have a public celebration of the Juneteenth, but in fact, if you look up Matthew Gaines and if you look up Texas Governor Edmund Davis, you'll see that the same slanders that the Klan did against them in those days are still up there. They're the official history, which is totally false.
Okay, I have that's a great segue in for Mr. Larry Robbins. You mentioned in our earlier conversation that you had a book about Jim Crow. This is
it's the same period that he's talking about, where at the end of Reconstruction, and this guy, a very famous historian, Woodward, wrote a book called The Strange Career of Jim Crow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and people kind of were thinking that segregation always existed, but in fact, under Reconstruction, there wasn't segregation. And what developed was Tom Watson developed this agrarian movement, and it was bringing together black and white sharecroppers to challenge the big landowners. And what Woodward shows is how Jim Crow was created to divide the black and white sharecroppers and break that movement by instituting a system of racism.
Okay. And what is the name of the book that you're referring to?
The Strange Career of Jim Crow.
The Strange Career of Jim Crow. Who was it written by?
Woodward is his last name.
Woodward.
He's a famous historian.
And what year, you know?
I read it probably 30 years ago.
Okay, Strange Career of Jim Crow. All right, anyone want to add to the Jim Crow conversation? And, Tony, I want to thank you for giving us that great information on June 10th, and we're not finished with you. I hope you can stay on.
Okay.
Anyone else? I know Judy had to run. She was on her way to a cookout. So we have Will left. We have, of course, my co-host, Mr. Jerry Butler, the finance doctor, and about four other people on the line.
Well, you know, this is Jerry Butler. I'd like to thank you so much. That was Tony that was speaking, correct?
Yeah.
Right.
You seem to have a plethora of knowledge going back in terms of reconstructing history and giving us a better and clearer view of exactly what has gone on that has brought us up to this point in terms of us being able to see just how far we have come. And I must admit, can't help but wonder, or maybe just try to attempt to conceive just what type of pain the slaves endured, just from the Johnson incident of having to make the decision of leaving your family behind for you to become free, to actually escaping captivity time and time again, and not to mention to find out later on in life that you had been freed a year or two beforehand and not been notified.
Right.
That's exactly what happened.
You know, so I just want to thank you so much for bringing so much to light. Matthew Gaines, this was indeed the slave that repeatedly escaped.
Yes.
Okay. And again,
1840.
Well, wait a minute, Tony.
Yeah.
We have three people on the chat in the chat room that are just amazed by the information. I'm going to read some of the comments. One is saying, wow, I currently live in Texas. I'm not a native, and I have never heard of any of this information. This is enlightening. I will have to pick up The Strange Career of Jim Crow. And I guess that is also, that compliment is also going to you, Mr. Larry Robbins. So I think because so many of these people are responding to this conversation between the Jim Crow and the June 10th conversation, I think we need to rehash what we just said so that the new people in the chat room could get a better understanding of what we're talking about. Don't you agree, Will?
Yes.
Okay.
Definitely.
Tony, would you just go over, not the exact same information, but just...
Right, well, let me set the stage. Why is Juneteenth, and indeed the Civil War, so crucial for all Americans? If you look, we were talking about the state of Texas. Texas is, in general, an evil place.
Tony, we're not going to call.
I want to be very specific. I have a very specific meaning to that.
Tony,
I wrote a book called George Bush, the Unauthorized Biography.
Tony. Now, you know you and I, we could talk about that. This is a Sunday. I chose Sunday to have this talk show so that we stay in good spirit, because we have other shows on TV and other places.
I'm always in good spirits.
But I don't want you calling anybody any names, okay? If we could just stay
even
a little
state?
More positive. A state, the ex-president, former president, let's stick with the good people. They don't get any platforms. We have to lift up these great people, and
right.
That's what I want to do. I don't want to talk about the negative, because they take over the airwaves all the time, and we're not going to give them 1 second today. Can we have an agreement on that, my panelists?
Oh,
can I get some backup? Can I get some support? Help me out with Tony, y'all.
The tradition of the emancipation of mankind that we get from the American Revolution, which we won again in the Civil War, flowered briefly in Texas after the Civil War, following the there were two steps. One step was the proclamation by the U.S. Army in Galveston in June of 1865 of the emancipation that had been declared 2 years earlier by President Lincoln. Of course, that emancipation proclamation couldn't be effective until the Army, including 100 to 200,000 black soldiers, actually won the war against the slave owners. So that's the way it was made effective. So once they had this emancipation declared in Texas, they had to, in a sense, win this again by Congress taking away from the president, the new president that succeeded the murdered Lincoln, Andrew Johnson, who was a stooge for the slave owners.
Okay.
He didn't want any of the amendments ending, giving citizenship and so forth. So in Texas, once the Congress put in the Reconstruction laws and put troops down there with President Grant sending them, then the people in Texas set up a government that was largely sparked by a black politician named Matthew Gaines.
How do you spell his name?
MATTHEWGAINES.
Okay, what did he do?
He was born in 1840 and died in 1900. He was a Republican state senator, and he was a state senator in the state legislature, but that was so important because that state, that group of political leaders, with him as the effective leader of the black population in Texas, was the main force behind a governor named Edmund Davis, who had been Edmund Davis, D-A-V-I-S. He was governor of Texas back in that period around 1870. I don't have in front of me the exact dates. But they when they came in, they took advantage, for example, of a law passed by Lincoln and the Congress to set up state colleges. They set up the Texas A&M College. And it's really due to particularly to Matthew Gaines, and they're trying to set up a statue to his honor on that campus. They never honored him before. But they also set up public schools for the state of Texas. And the former Confederate leaders organized in the Ku Klux Klan tried to stop all of this progress and tried to stop the establishment of a state college or a public school system for white people as well as for black people. They wanted feudalism. So this is a great struggle that took place. And finally, after the U.S. Pulled the troops out of the South under a corrupt president, Rutherford Hayes, who was backed by Wall Street and the British, the Klan element was put in charge again. The old Confederate element was put back in charge in Texas and other states, and they abolished the public schools that had been set up by this great government.
Okay,
so this
great.
Is a very important struggle with ramifications to our present day.
You got that right. Now let's go back to Larry Robbins. Explain how the book that you highly recommend for our audience to purchase, explain how that ties in to Juneteenth Day and what Tony was just talking about. Larry?
Yeah. You know, do you want me to talk about Lorraine again, or you want to talk about Charlie Blackman?
Jim Crow
book. Or, huh?
The Jim Crow book.
Jim Crow book. Okay. I'm sorry. So there's a book called The Strange Career of Jim Crow, and the reason this historian wrote it is because people kind of assume that segregation always existed. And the fact is that the things Tony was talking about took place throughout the country. There were black legislatures in all of the southern states. Yeah, with the backing of the army, there was a total changeover in how things were being run. And there was the beginning of a movement called a populist movement with a fellow by the name of Tom Watson leading it, that was bringing together black and white sharecroppers to organize to resist these huge landowners who had run the former plantations, who, once slavery was over, wanted to maintain the system. And he was being successful, and there was this large populist movement going throughout the South. And what happened is they created this racist, segregationist caricature of Jim Crow to break up this movement and to get whites to basically abandon the progressive movement and working with blacks for everyone's betterment. The story doesn't end. I mean, it's the same stuff's going on today, the same things Tony's talking about.
Okay, we have a question.
Also, just going on today, both in Texas and throughout the country.
All right, the name of the book is A Strange Career of Jim Crow.
Of Jim Crow, right.
You're speaking to Larry Robbins, Tony Chaitin, the finance doctor, Mr. Jerry Butler. We also have on Will Worley, the historian, high school administrator. And we have someone calling from 973-926. I'm going to put you on right now. Say hello. How are you? Are you on the air? Oh, they hung up. I guess they just want to listen in. Let's go back to Larry Robbins. Larry, there are three other books on your list that you want
right.
to talk about.
And by the way, the author of that, The Strange Crow of Jim Crow, his name is C. Van, V-A-N-N, Woodward, W-O-O-D-W-A-R-D. And he was a terrific historian. I'm not sure when it was written, but I read it years and years and years ago.
Okay, 973, please call back in. I will not put you on the air, so you don't have to worry about it. Larry, there's three
okay.
or four other books that you want to talk about.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about Charles Loxton a little bit. Charles Loxton had just retired a couple years ago, but he had one of the largest collections of black books and memorabilia next to the Schomburg here in Philadelphia at Temple University.
Let's spell his name for our listeners. Charles Loxton.
Charles Loxton, B-L-O-C-K-S-O-N. And his story is a wonderful story because what started him collecting, he lived in an area just outside of Philadelphia called Norristown, and he's in his mid-70s now. But when he was in high school and in class and they were talking about what the various ethnic groups did in American history, and he said to his teacher, well, what did my people do? And the history teacher said, oh, black people didn't do anything. And he knew better than that, right? And he came into Philadelphia, and there was this great old used bookstore called Leary's, and it was a five-story bookstore, and they had bins of books on the outside and just tons of books. And he's a teenager, and he's come in from the suburbs, and, he's going to go find something on black history. And this is in the 50s, right? And so he's walking there, and he picks up this book, and it's William Still's Underground Railroad, and he flips it open, and there's a picture of his uncle arriving in Canada, 100 years ago. And
wow!
It's the first book he bought, for $5, when he was as a teenager, and he ended up with, thousands and thousands of volumes, and being one of the real experts both on the Underground Railroad and black genealogy, and especially African American history in the Pennsylvania, the tri-state area here around Philadelphia. And he was just he just retired, but he was just a treasure of information. I'd be with him, and someone would come up and introduce themselves, and they'd say their name. And he says, "Oh, that name. Well, your uncle was so and so, and that family came from North Carolina." And he would just go off into the person's genealogy, just knowing the names and how the migration paths worked. It was just an amazing thing.
Right, Mr. Bloxon, like you said, is a curator of the Temple Library. He just retired, so if you go to Temple University or you know anyone from Temple, alumni, or current student, his collection is there at Temple University.
Yeah, it's the Charles L. Bloxon collection at Temple University.
I met him in person at William Steele's family reunion. They continue to have William Steele's family reunion in Lawnside, New Jersey, and Mr. Bloxon is there every year. So if you are into collecting books and meeting great historians like myself, if you go to the Steele's reunion, I think this will be their 150th reunion in Lawnside, New Jersey. This weekend at Lorraine Carey's Black Writers Expo Book Fair in Philadelphia, I met Jerry Pickney. He's the illustrator of the National Geographic magazine, which is dedicated to Underground Railroad. This story was published in 1983 or 84, and I was able to meet Mr. Pickney and have him autograph my magazine. And Charles Bloxon is featured in that magazine. Anyone have, Will, you want to make a comment? You have a question?
No, I don't have any questions. I guess the only, comment that I would make is just picking back on what Tony and I were talking about in terms of the black codes that eventually came out of the South and put black people or the former enslaved Africans into, that serfdom and servitude. And I just want to be clear that I try to use the word enslaved versus the word slave. And I remember, and Larry may know his name, Malefe Asante from Temple, where he talked about the distinction between using the word enslaved versus slave, and basically said that enslaved talks about the person's condition, whereas slave talks about a person, and we want to talk about the condition, not necessarily about the person. So I just wanted to add that little tidbit. But I think I learned just as much as the audience from hearing these two gentlemen speak, so I appreciate being a part of the dialogue.
Oh, no, we're learning from you just as well. My co-host, are you still out there?
Oh, yes, most definitely. And I'm all ears and studied taking down notes. And I want to thank each and every one of the panelists that have actually taken an active part in this. And I have to say, all of you have. Tony, I'm telling you, it took the young lady to tie you down because you were going to get wide open. I can tell on a Sunday, you don't care if it's Sunday, Monday, holiday, rainy day, you ready to get wide open. I see. And you in the 757 area code?
No, I'm down here in Virginia.
Is that 757?
703.
703. Oh, 703. Oh, so you up near like Northern Virginia?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, and I'm in Virginia Beach.
Oh, okay. You're down in Pat Robertson's home base.
Yeah, old 700 Club. Leave it alone.
All right. All right. Mr. Robbins, you had about three other books or topics you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about Richard Wright.
Okay.
This past year, here in Philadelphia, this was the Richard Wright Centennial in April of 08. 08 was the Richard Wright Centennial. And as part of the centennial, his daughter, Julia, who lives in Paris, spent some time in the U.S. And in Philadelphia, we did a whole series of events with her for a week in April. But there are a couple things. One is the significance of Richard Wright and when he published Native Son. And it was very interesting. Part of what we were doing here is we put together a program in the public schools and teacher training around Richard Wright. And the challenge, one of the challenges that you have in working with young people is getting them to see the relevance of history and how things have come to be. And Richard Wright is just a pivotal person. Native Son was the first time a book by a black person was on a bestseller list. It was the first time that the conditions in which black people lived was presented in a way that made it intelligible to white people who had absolutely no concept of what conditions in ghettos were like. That probably isn't quite true. One of the things of the Civil Rights Act movement, and one of the principles behind Martin Luther King was that if America knew what was going on, they would stop it. And that's part of what Richard Wright was involved in too. And that's true to, I think that's true to a large extent, but then that doesn't deal with the whole issue of racism and institutional racism and the things we were talking about, the June 10th thing and the whole, I'm getting off the line here, but, you know, the whole issue of the prison systems and how the prisons continue the whole thing of the black laws out of the South that were used to re-enslave black people. I'm gonna. Tony, what do you think? I mean, you talked about this. There's a connection here. Bring this contemporary, that the same things that went on in Texas, the same things that went on in the South, going on now around the way prisons are dealt with.
Well, let me. I'd like to make this very contemporary. There's a very famous African American teacher named Cornel West. And he was a professor at Harvard University for many years. And you can read his book called Democracy Matters. And there's a section in there about the struggle that took place at Harvard University, not sought by him, but a struggle imposed on him by the man who was then the president of Harvard, Lawrence Summers.
Right.
And what happened there is that Summers had been an economist, real right-wing economist, and came in as president of Harvard and immediately went to war against Cornel West and belittled everything that the African Studies Department was doing, and particularly wanted to dump West because he was so popular among the students.
Right.
And so what happened is that Cornel West was really forced to leave Harvard University. The crucial thing here is that 2 years after the faculty of Harvard voted to get rid of Larry Summers as president of Harvard in 2006, he somehow became the head of economics in the Obama administration. And
here you go again. Hold on, we have a caller calling
in. Well, just let me finish. His policy is now to put through a health care reform that would basically ban medical health care for the poor and the elderly and so forth. They're talking about removing $2 trillion out of health care to keep up bailouts for the banks. So this is the kind of struggle we're talking about back in the Civil War era.
We have someone trying to call in. Caller, I'm going to open up your line. If you want to say hi, you say hi. If you don't, I'll just close your line, and you don't have to worry about anything. Hello?
Hello.
Are you here, 718?
Yeah. This is Leslie?
Yes, this is Leslie.
This is Philip. How you doing?
How are you, Philip? I'm doing great. Have you been listening for a while?
I just got on.
Oh, you missed him. You missed him. Yeah, well, when you get back on, make sure you go back and listen. Tell him, Jerry and Will. Shouldn't he come back? And you should go online, and it'll be archived, and you need to listen to this entire show from the beginning.
I couldn't even get it on the webpage. For some reason, I couldn't get through. Is it blogtalkradio.com, Black Antique E-Show?
Right. All right.
Don't forget the forward slash.
Antique E-Show, or even go to the search and just type in Leslie Gist or anything antique or Black Antique or Antique E-Show, and you'll come right to it. Now, I know exactly where Larry Robbins was going with his question and his comment. You're saying that today's prison system is a modern-day slave or slave plantation. Isn't that where you were going, Mr. Robbins?
Well, not only is it, but, you know, the 13th Amendment outlaws slavery except as punishment and except in prisons, right? So, I mean, we literally have a slave system through the prison system, right? And what is being done now is you know, incarcerating the large amounts of people and then renting them out to corporations.
Right, right.
You know, and if that isn't slavery, I don't know what it is.
It is slavery.
You know, prison system is next to Walmart. The prison system is the only growth industry in America.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Will, what do you have to say about Larry's comment?
Yeah, well, Angela Davis wrote an article several years ago called The Prison Industrial Complex that highlighted and talked about this very topic in terms of particularly how African-American males are disproportionately represented in the prisons throughout the country and how, you know, they're being used sometimes in telemarketing in different industries like that and how some of these companies are now, you know, being traded or have stock on Wall Street that people can purchase based upon the fact that they've committed crimes. And some of these crimes, you know, the people have committed or are charged or accused of committing are ones that the people wonder if they actually, in fact, should be doing as much time as they are. And so I think there's a great correlation between what we were talking about earlier in terms of reading and education with what you see in terms of young men, particularly African-American young men, being shipped off, it seems, right from the school to the prison as opposed to the colleges and universities. So I think that there is a correlation between what you saw happening with the black codes and shifting African-Americans back into that system of servitude to what we have now where there's a large population of young men who are entering the prison system and as a result are stigmatized and even when they get out, they're limited in what they could do because they lack those skills. And then you see the recidivism continuing because they go back into lives of crime that continues to perpetuate the system.
Well, I'm going to take
and also, many states don't permit ex-felons to vote. Yeah, and one of the interesting things is you have these prisons, and they're put into these, you know, white rural areas, and the prisoners are counted in terms of population for what they get
for what the county gets, but not but they don't have any right to vote. They have no input.
Well, I'll have to tap into that that comment. What we're talking about is a reinvention of the 3/5 clause, which is the same the same exact thing that's happening now today. Is the counties, which are housing these prisons, they get credit for those people as residents, which affects the population, which affects how many representatives they get in Washington, and thus they get people to represent them without taxation, without representation. But they're not the prisons. The prisons are being counted, and these towns which house the prisons get credit, get grants, and everything associated with the population increase. I'm going to go to a little break really fast for about 1 minute, and we're going to all regain our composure. And Larry Robbins, come up with the next topic, and I think I have the perfect track to introduce it.
The African Free School.
Oh, Leslie?
Soon after the revolution, in 1785, a group of wealthy, powerful white men formed the New York Manumission Society. Their mission was to aid the enslaved and to gradually end slavery in the state. As part of their efforts, they opened the African Free School in 1788, where the children of both free and enslaved blacks were taught reading, writing, arithmetic, and geography. The boys also studied astronomy, a skill needed by seamen, and the girls learned sewing and knitting. The school had many visitors, especially on examination days when students could show off their work to outsiders. In this way, they could prove to doubting New Yorkers that black students were not inferior to those of fairer complexions in acquiring a knowledge of letters. The school began with about 40 students in one room. In the 1820s, as the date of freedom for New York State slaves drew near, the enrollment grew to 800 students. By 1834, when the African Free Schools were absorbed into the New York public school system, over 1,400 students were enrolled in 7 school buildings. Many of the students of the African Free School went on to become community leaders. James McCune Smith became the first African-American licensed doctor. Henry Highland Garnett was a leading abolitionist and the first African-American to address Congress. And Ira Aldridge became the most famous African-American actor of his day. As students, these men had learned the art of public speaking. As adults, many used their skills to speak out for freedom, justice, and equality for their race. As adults, many used that skill to speak out for freedom, justice, and equality for their race.
Okay, we're back on. Do I have everybody? I want to make sure everybody is still with me. Mr. Larry Robbins, are you still here?
Yep.
Okay, do we have the finance doctor, Mr. Jerry Butler?
You know I'm not going anywhere.
Do we have the historian here from Newark?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. And Tony Chaitin, our other historian from Virginia. Tony, are you there? I hope I didn't mute him. Okay, Larry, we're going to go with you.
I'm going to throw something else out. There's a great man by the name of Derrick Bell. We were talking a little bit earlier about Harvard and how they got rid of Cornell West.
Yes. Yes.
Derrick Bell was also at Harvard in the law department, except he quit over their racial policy because they were not, while he had tenure, they were not granting tenure to other black professors. And actually, it might have been around this whole thing with Derrick Bell or with Cornell West. But Derrick Bell actually quit Harvard and ended up at NYU. But he wrote some great books, and one of the books he wrote is called Silent Covenant. And he was one of the lawyers that worked on the Brown versus the Board of Education, the desegregation case. And he wrote this for the 50th anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Ed. And he said what he said, and he makes an interesting thing to think about, is that we made a mistake, that we thought that integration would work and that it would increase the quality of education for young black students, but that in fact what happened was that whites took their kids out of the public school systems. And once they took their kids out of the systems, then they started objecting to paying for public education. So that the result of Brown versus the Board of Education was really very much became the destruction of the public education system and the defunding of it, and that all these great young black teachers, a whole class of teachers who taught in segregated schools, who taught pride and history to young black kids, were put out of work and were replaced by young white teachers that were afraid and didn't teach at all.
Okay,
well, I'm throwing that out as a discussion. This is a book by Derek Bell, who's a great, but, and all of this relates to all the other stuff we've been talking about, of course.
Yeah, you know, I like to chime in. Actually, Derek Bell, he has another book, And We Are Not Saved, which the part of the title comes from a speech that Frederick Douglass wrote called Free the Slaves and Leave Them Alone, which talked about what should happen to the enslaved Africans after the Union is successful in winning the war. And he wrote that speech or delivered that speech in 1862. So I was kind of interested when you stated Derek Bell, because I believe he's an excellent author and one of my favorites.
Okay, now we're down to our last 5 minutes. I'd like to give everybody a chance to have a closing statement, something that you would want to tell the audience and you want them to remember you by, a comment. Let's go. Who wants to be first?
Leslie, actually, this is Tina, and I got
Tina
on the conversation kind of late, but I called in because I heard that you came down to Sanctuary, to the festival yesterday, and
I
called to thank you for coming and coming down, and I wish you, if I had known you were coming, I would have made sure you had the opportunity maybe to meet the people you might have wanted to meet. But I'm calling actually from CBW, a Celebration of Black Right, and I'm on the board of directors of our Sanctuary. So
I had a lovely time. My baby had a good time. We bought books and more books. Tell us more about that, the festival.
Well, we have a festival every year, and Larry Robbins, who's on the phone, he actually started the festival 25 years ago. And then, I think he turned it over to Lorraine in, 2003, Larry?
I think it was 02, but I'm not sure.
02, and then Lorraine Carey stepped in and started taking it over. But every year we try to build on it, and this year I think we built a little bit more. We try to make it better every year, but the whole festival is about to celebrate black writers. So
I thank you, Tina, for calling up and for listening. I hope to have a few of these gentlemen back on next week or within the next 2 weeks. Will, would you like to say something before you leave?
Sure. I would just like to say to the young people that are listening that you cannot conquer what you will not face or confront, and I just want to encourage young people, particularly high school age students, to confront some of the realities that are facing our community. And one of the best things they could do is pick up a book, a good book, and read and really stay out of the penal system.
Okay, we have 90 seconds, I think, because Larry Robbins is our featured guest. Larry, give us your email, your website, all your information, and we're going to leave out.
Okay. It's www.robbinsbookstore.com. And,
okay. Your phone number, your address?
It's 110 South 13th Street in Philadelphia. Phone number is 215-735-9600. And I just want to reemphasize what was just said by the other gentleman of the importance of reading and of learning history, and we can't solve the problems we have today if we don't understand where they came from.
You're right about that.
Right. Dr. Finance Doctor, go.
Oh, I'm here right now. I'd like to thank you all so much, all the panelists. You've definitely imparted some very deep information on us. Is Tony still on the line also?
Yes.
Okay, Tony.
My information?
Yes, Tony, would you let the listeners know how they can call you or get in touch with you?
Yeah, my website where we do this intelligence is LaRouchePeck, LaRouchePeck.
Wait a minute, LaRouche.
CHE.
CHE.
And then PAC.com, LaRouchePeck. It's the LaRouche Political the LaRouche Political Action Committee. And my
is that .com, .org?
Yeah, LaRouchePeck.com. And my email is Chaitkin, that's C-H-A-I-T-K-I-N, Chaitkin@Verizon.net. You know, I can send you, there's an article I did on how Frederick Douglass created the modern city of Washington, D.C.
Spell Chaitkin again.
Chaitkin, C-H-A-I-T-K-I-N.
Okay, Chaitkin@Verizon.net.
That's it.
How about you? Do you have a contact number you'd like to give out to the listeners, Tony?
Trying to think of the best, best number. Hold on 1 second. I got to get this stupid cell phone. I'm not
the
a
The show's
master.
Over, but we're still, they said, we're not streaming, but we're still on.
That's fine.
Okay.
Here we go. The number is the number for the committee is 800-929-7566, and that's just ask for me, Anton Chaitkin.
Okay. What about you, Will? We want to make sure we don't want to leave you out.
Oh, it's 862-252-3369, and the email
yep.
is and the email is. Q Storm STORM SPR the number 8 the number 9 at AOL.
Okay, give that again. That's Q Storm
SPR the number 8 the number 9 at AOL.com.
Okay. You got a website you'd like to give out to the listeners as well?
No, I don't.
Okay. Okay, that's Q Storm STR 89@AOL.com.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Right. Well,
all right. I had a great time, fellas.
Thanks, Leslie.
Yes, and can we get together again?
Thank you. Yes,
sir.
Okay, I'll give each one of you a call individually. I knew I would have a good time. I hope you guys enjoyed yourselves.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, we'll talk again.
Bye-bye, everybody.
All right, thank you all.
Good night, everyone.
Bye-bye.